how'd this album come to be? I mean, it's been 5 years since your last studio album. You guys are always busy, but what made you guys get back into the studio?
Well, actually, it was Gunner's idea, and I got to give him pretty much full credit for this one. He was actually kind of moonlighting while we were off working and touring and stuff like that. He was kind of putting this album together, and he called me when he was about 3/4 of the way, finished with most of the tunes in his own home studio, and said, hey, why don't you come over and, you know, give it your polish and play your bass, your vocals, and maybe write a couple of tunes to finish it off. And that's really how it kind of came to be. I was actually, I'm going to be honest with you, I was pretty surprised because Gunner and I had kind of talked about taking a sabbatical from the sound for a while to work on other things. And, you know, it just, he kind of, to be honest with you, Gunner kind of lives in this milieu a little bit more than I do these days. So it was something that he really wanted to do. And I think he did, you know, he did a good job for what it is.
So you had to have heard something that you liked to kind of bring you back, you know? So considering that, what do you think makes this album a special one?
Well, I think for the most part, as I said, it's special and unique in the sense that it's kind of a going away, like a parting shot, if you will, for that sound for us. Because in the reality of it is nowadays, you know, it's all about touring. It's about playing live. You know, bands that are making records, unless of course you're Iggy Azalea or something, you know, that's literally, you know, you're a teenager and you're doing teen pop and it's, you know, in the top 40 and you've got, you know, huge dollars behind it. The reality of it is legacy bands like Nelson, you know, are all about touring, and thank God we still do it. And I think we do it well. And Gunn and I are always on the road, it seems, to make our living. So, I think what makes it interesting is that I see a lot of bands now are kind of coming to the point in their careers, at least bands that have been around for a long time, that it seems to be smarter to work on the live show than it is on their albums. And the thing is, Gunner and I have a real, you know, focused stand, you know, from a focused position that we really don't want to, you know, do something that we're going to regret releasing. That's the only thing I got to say that's different about us. And I'd say, you know, there are quite a few people that just kind of release their demos. You know, if they go, oh, well, it's just not going to do anything, and, you know, it's for the hardcore fans, and they'll love anything we throw at them, and we kind of don't feel that way. You know, we're all about, you know, doing the best that we can. And again, on this one, you know, Gunner, you know, I kind of acquiesced and let him take the reins on this one while I work on some other projects for us. So there you go. I think that's what makes it different is that, you know, I know that he was really focused on doing the best that he possibly could as the last studio album for Nelson.
You spoke earlier about legacy. I mean, it's been 25 years. What do you think the band's legacy is?
Well, I think that, you know, the sound of our band is unique in the sense that it's two brothers singing. But we're a lot of hard rock and heavy pop bands, you know, especially a lot of the bands that were happening when we started breaking, were really based out of a blues background from a song standpoint. You know, Gunner and I were always song oriented. You know, we always believed, as far as writing was concerned, to write hits. You know, it's not good enough just write songs. And, you know, the playing has to be, that's academic. It has to be the best. You have to have the best players, the best parts. That's really not the songs that people remember, I think. So what made us unique and what makes us unique still, I think, in that whole genre is that we kind of came more from that California, I'm going to say, kind of folk background. You know, it's like folk and California music, you know, going from, you know, early 60s from the Beach Boys all the way through our dad's stuff that he was doing with the Stone Canyon Band, which is more country rock, and the Byrds, the Hollies, you know, the Eagles, the things like that. You know, it was more, it wasn't blues-oriented. And, you know, you had your other bands, they totally nailed that. They had that whole genre. But I got to say, it's a little, in my opinion, it's a little harder to sound tough or sound aggressive or have some meat on the bone coming from the background that we did, which is growing up in Southern California with those musical influences. I mean, the truth of the matter is you play great blues and you turn the guitars up and, you know, I mean, AC/DC's done a great job with it. We just knew that that's not what we did.
Yeah. So you told me earlier that Gunner was responsible for a big chunk of the album, but Rockstar, what did you think the first time you heard it? How did that song come together? It's got a lot of energy.
It does have a lot of energy. Well, the funny thing was, I said, okay, Nickelback had a song called Rockstar. You know, was a very different approach to it, you know. And again, Gunnar wrote this one, so I heard. I actually really liked the riff, and when I heard it, you know, from a production standpoint, song standpoint, I added a bit of comments on the verses and stuff, yeah. and things to just kind of bring it, you know, another 20%. But you know, the truth was, we didn't pick the singles on this album. The record company did, and I think it was our job to make an album, and we always try to that they can pick whatever they want to pick, and we'll support it. You know, we can't, if we're releasing anything that there's a, you know, a dramatic hole as far as material is concerned, something that would be embarrassing if we had supported it as a single, that'd probably be a problem. But in this one, I got to say, it's, you know, Gunnar did a really good job, and it's consistent for what it is.
You mentioned earlier that you guys have this kind of, this different sound, this more folk-based sound, and I love your ballads and things like that. I mean, I grew up on bands like you guys, Mr. Big and Extreme and all that stuff. And when I heard I Want to Stay Home, I felt like there was some of that there. There was some of that older, like ballady, but kind of there's a lot of rock in there. How did that song come together?
Well, Gunnar is really a fan of 70s schmaltz ballads, you know, what he calls soft rock, 70s golden rock kind of stuff. He loves that stuff. I mean, he's like an encyclopedia of knowledge for 70, like Seals and Crofts and things like that. So,
nice.
You know, I think that's probably where it came from. It's funny you mentioned, you know, we play shows with Eric Martin from Mr. Big with our side project Scrap Metal, and Paul Geary from Extreme is a really good friend of ours, and he's in the management world now. But, you know, everybody thinks that Nelson did More Than Words, which I think is hysterical. You know, we actually were thinking about covering it just to kind of get it out of the way. You know?
Oh, that'd be great.
But, yeah, it would be fun. But that's really where it came from. And, you know, a lot of bands, I remember when our debut album came out, you know, a lot of bands kind of had to have the obligatory ballad. I know Eric wrote To Be With You in high school for mm-hmm. his girlfriend, you know, and that was one thing he had kind of in his back pocket. And I think the nice thing about ballads just in general is it gives you a chance to stretch out vocally a little bit. And, I guess what you can say is clearly, for the most part, Nelson's really always been about melody.
Mm-hmm.
And so it's nice from, you know, once in a while to release a song like Rockstar that has kind of a riff, you know, you know, it's like, cool. You know, we also like riff rock too, but, you know, when it gets to the chorus, you go, oh, it's a Nelson song, you know? I want to live like I'm a rock star. And it's all melody.
Mm-hmm.
So I think it's a matter of balance, isn't it? I think that's what works with Gunnar and I. We're twins, but we're really different men. We're different people.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of almost like, I'm not, you know, we aspire to be Lennon and McCartney. You know, they always had... They had their differences, both creatively and personally. But I think when you put people together that are like that, even twins, it makes for better music.
All right, let's have a little bit of fun. Based on the way the band sounds, people will expect that you guys have certain influences. But if you can, tell me a couple of bands that you love that you're kind of ashamed to tell people. Bands that, like, you kind of, they're like your guilty pleasure favorites that have found a way to influence you over the years.
That found a way to influence me?
Yeah.
Gosh, I don't, you know what, I'll be honest with you, I'm not ashamed of anything I like, so I mean, and I'm not joking, I mean, you know, there were elements of, you know, David Cassidy I thought were amazing, you know, mm-hmm. And the Carpenters and things like that, you know, stuff that people would be ashamed, I'm not going to go Leif Garrett, but I'm not going to, you know, I'm just going to say things that people would be ashamed to mention, but you can't take away from the songs, you know, you just can't. So I think, let's say this way, you know, one thing I've noticed, both from being a music fan and being a musician, is there are always bands that just are cool to like, you know, and every kid, every fan wants to be in a tribe, you know, nobody mm-hmm. wants to be caught with a, oh, you like that uncool band. You know, I think cool is anything that people embrace, you know, artists embrace that say, this is what we do, and we're unapologetic. And we're not going to try to be all things to all people. If you like it, great. If you don't, well, then go find something else. And I think that's cool. And so I think, you know, for me, you know, I got to say that unlike a lot of people there, I mean, I can tell you that I'm kind of a fan of a lot of stuff. You know, I thought the Spice Girls were amazing for what it was, you know?
Yeah.
I did.
Absolutely. I did. Same
I
here.
Genius construction of pop music. It was perfect.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so and it is what it is. You know, I'm a fan of a lot of different things.
Okay, I always like to ask bands that have had multiple hits but have always had that one song that people go back to over and over, how that affects your career. I mean, you guys have had multiple hits, but it's that one song that a lot of people, I mean, kind of come back to. You guys were on the wall of like DJ Tanner from Full House because of that song, you know? So how does it feel to kind of always have that on you? Is it a help? Is it a negative? How does it feel to have that one monster hit that like people like kill to have?
Well, you know, that's a really good question, actually. And for me, you know, there are two songs that tie with that one. It's either Love and Affection or After the Rain.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they were almost the same on the charts.
Yeah.
And people tend to know us more, believe it or not, for After the Rain, which didn't quite go to number one, but Love and Affection did. So, you know, things like, you know, watching Full House reruns and seeing our poster on the wall. I mean, clearly, you know, we're going through what our dad went through.
Yeah.
You know, he was fortunate enough to, like his dad, you know, we've had three successive generations of number one hit makers. And everybody asked him the same question, you know, which was, well, how are you going to top this? What are you going to do in the future? I found an interview when my dad had just released his first hit song. And the reviewer said, so how are you going to top your father? I mean, he was around for years with his big band. And, you know, do you honestly think you're going to have another hit? And all he said was, well, I'll try to do what I can and see what the future holds. He wound up selling 280 million singles and is in the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame and, you know, top five of all time selling recording artists. So that hasn't changed. But one thing that he went through, I think that we are too, is that, you know, he was identified clearly with what was happening in the 50s. And it was hard because he was on television for mm-hmm. 14 years. And so it was hard for the audience and the world at large, really, to let him grow up. And when he got to Madison Square Garden for an oldies show that he didn't want to play, he put together another band. He'd done another, you know, made a right turn away from what people had known in the 50s, you know, to boot him off the stage for playing new songs and looking different. And he wrote Garden Party about that experience and had the biggest hit ever. So I think we're kind of going through the same thing, too, because, of course, everybody remembers Nelson. Oh, you know, those guys with the long blonde hair. You know, I cut my hair in 95, and yeah, I miss it sometimes or whatever. But, you know, we actually had our image for a reason. Nobody told us to do that. We had actually spent some time in Europe writing songs. And in Europe, unlike America at the time, you know, image was as important, if not more important, than music. I mean, the Spice Girls broke out of England, for instance, mm-hmm. you know, it was an image thing and with great songs. And so, you know, we had people that we were working with that said, you guys have to really decide what you're going to do. And our statement was, sure, long hair with no product in it, no makeup, but we wanted to go color where everybody else was wearing black leather. And, you know, our thing was love us or hate us, you know who we are. Look, we're 25 years later, people still know who we are,
mm-hmm.
you know, for that. And we've definitely taken lumps for it. However, I'm not going to apologize because there was no guarantee whatsoever that people were going to pay any attention to us. And so it's kind of nice now looking back 25 years later, we're about to release a remaster version of the After the Rain album.
Wow.
With a couple of new cuts and stuff on Universal. And do a push with that as well. It's kind of nice to kind of have this album, you know, the Peace Out album, and mm-hmm. it's kind of like the beginning and the end all in one year.
Wow.
And we'll play, you know, rare dates to support the album when it makes sense. I mean, we're playing a show in Las Vegas at the Hard Rock. They're going to do a poolside concert series. You know, it's kind of a big deal, and we're going to be doing that, I think, in a month. And, you know, all we're going to do is go out there and be us. And if people dig it, great. And I hope they do.
I've scoured the web basically for like the last week trying to find a real good interview with the influence behind, you know, I Can't Live Without Your Love and Affection. All I could seem to get is that it was inspired by Cindy Crawford. So
kind of, yeah. Well, here's what happened. Gunnar and I spent a lot of time writing by ourselves and with a co-writer named Mark Tanner.
Mm-hmm.
And Mark Tanner at the time wound up producing the After the Rain album, but that was after a false start with a couple of hotshot producers that shall remain nameless and couldn't tap in what we were doing. And I remember Gunnar and I were it was probably one of the hotter days of the year. I had a dog, a Labrador Retriever, that I had fed the wrong food to, so she had gas. And I remember feeling like, okay, it's hot in this room, the dog has gas, all my friends are at the beach, is this worth it? And I just kind of zoned out, you know, and I had, you know, various things around me and various pictures, and I just kind of zoned out, and I started playing this riff on my 12-string acoustic, I had a Martin 12-string, and all of a sudden I hear, and Gunner runs down the hall, and he says, what the hell was that? I said, I don't know what. He goes, what you were just playing? I said, what was I just playing? And he held up a little, remember micro cassette recorders?
Mm-hmm.
And he had recorded it.
Wow.
Just like a bar of it. And that's where Love and Affection started, is my zoning out on a hot, miserable, stinky day. And I just went to some place to kind of escape the moment, and it kind of came through me. And we kind of went from there. We wrote a little bit more of that progression. And for me, whenever I write music, it'll usually make me feel something, you know, whether it be if it's an angry song, it comes out through the music or whatever, and the melody will come. And that's what happened. The melody came, and then started writing the lyrics. And it's funny, I go online from time to time and see things, and people either say it's, you know, it's a great California, you know, rock song, or they'll say it's the number one soccer song on the planet. You know, it's pretty funny. But, you know, we had a good time writing it, but what I think what was really neat about it was at the time we were recording a record deal with Geffen Records and John Kolodner, who had Aerosmith and Whitesnake and things like that, and, you know, legends. I mean, he found AC/DC and things like that. And
mm-hmm.
If you remember the Dude Looks Like a Lady video for Aerosmith, he was the guy in the wedding dress with the beard.
Yeah.
he's one of the most famous record men in the business ever, and he was really tough on us, and what he would always have us record demos. We had a little studio that we went to in the Valley called the Green Room. And we would go in there with Mark Tanner, and we would usually record three songs we just wrote. Two would usually make the cut. One would always get shit canned. And we couldn't wait to record three. We went and recorded Love and Affection as a demo and went to John Kolodner's office. And we played live for him first and sang the song. And he had been on the fence about signing us. And it was actually that song and wow. playing live in his office. He picked up the phone, called the business affairs, and said, I've been waiting for this. This is what I wanted to hear. This is it. I want you guys to be the new Hollies. I want you guys to tap into your musical DNA. And I don't want you to be Aerosmith or Whitesnake. I want you to be you guys. I want you to do what you do that nobody else can do. And truthfully, you know, Gunner and I with two acoustic guitars is kind of where the music starts when we write, really. That's why we have very little in the riff rock.
Mm-hmm.
category. Because we write with each other and in a room, and it's usually a melody or something we have to say. And that's more of almost like a country sensibility than anything.
Very but true.
In the rock world, I think it makes us stand out and be different. It's the two brothers and that kind of acoustic bass. You know, it's almost like, you know, it's like a male version of Heart, to be honest with you.
Wow. So last question for me, you know, your brother, he's working on, you know, a reality show, but you've got a lot of cool little hobbies that a lot of people don't really know that you're into. So you want to talk about the racing a little bit and how that kind of is your escape from music?
Well, I used to race a whole lot more. Mm-hmm. And the fact is, it's really a young person's sport and it's very expensive. But I started racing after I did, I did some illegal street racing in LA, you know, up on Mulholland Drive in Sepulveda, and I did well, but I also saw some friends getting some big wrecks, and I was fortunate enough to have a hit record with the first album, and was asked to do the Long Beach Grand Prix, the celebrity race thing.
Mm-hmm.
So went up and did some schooling, and the instructor kind of suggested that I keep doing it. I qualified pole, and I had a good run, but I started out not winning races, but learning.
Mm-hmm.
And it's all about seat time. And, you know, a couple of years later, I started getting into faster cars and more training and started winning races. And, you know, at this point, you know, I tell my wife now, she's never seen me race because she'd probably have a heart attack. But there was a while where I was doing, you know, open wheel stuff like Formula Ford 1600 and things like that, or Shelby Can-Am. I tested that for a while. I was going to do that series and a lot of showroom stock. And then I wound up getting into karting, and I had a 48-horsepower shifter cart that I used to race in California, and that's about as close as you can get to racing an Indy car.
Mm-hmm.
You know, that's why, you know, those guys like Schumacher came right out of carts and went into F1, and I'll never be in something that's that twitchy and that fast again. I kind of want to get back into it, but the problem is I'm 47.
Yeah.
And I have a little boy, and the fact is, you know, it's tough to it's tough to convince yourself that kissing a wall at 140 miles an hour is worth, you know, not being able to take care of your family, you know? So mm-hmm. I think it's changed a little bit, you know, I've slowed down for the right reason though, mm-hmm. the family, you know, I sold my Harley because I was one of those guys that rode a Harley for transportation for 25 years in LA. And, I never got in a big wreck. And I figured, you know, I always say, you're either going to, you know, you're one of the guys, if you really ride, you're either going to wreck or you're going to wreck. And, you know, so I just basically sold that and bought a 69 Chevelle. And that's kind of my guilty pleasure. You know, it's the old muscle car thing I'm kind of into because, yeah, I got a little more metal around me, but it sounds nice.
Yeah.
And it's fast. But, yeah, as far as Gunner's reality show 4A's, you know, I know he did, Celebrity Wife Swap, which is, as I said, we're different guys. It's a show I would never do.
Yeah.
You know, mm-hmm. I just wouldn't do it, you know, and he's like, he's all about it. And, you know, half the time I have no idea what he's working on. I find out after the fact, you know?
Yeah.
And we live five minutes away from each other, and we're twins, and we tour all the time. So I think Gunner has more of a desire to do kind of his own thing, and I think he's afraid to tell me half of it. You know, for me, I tell him what's going on. I mean, I had a whole side project about 10 years ago that I did. It was a modern rock project called Red 37,
mm-hmm.
and it almost broke huge. And the lead singer kind of pulled out at the very last minute, but getting a lot of buzz. And it was completely different types of music. So, you know, I think that it's good for us as we get older to continue doing what we do together and to continue to experience things on our own as well. As I said, you know, it makes for better art.